Welcome to From the Studio, our presentation of conversations with artists and those connected with arts events here in the Inland Northwest. Today, it is my great pleasure to again welcome Spokane Symphony music director James Lowe. Good morning again, James.
Good morning yet again.
All right. You know, first of all, you'll get the parking place, and then there'll be the special chair. It's all yours. And a new person to me, Ashley Dixon, mezzo-soprano, who we'll find has a very deep background in both opera and in the song literature. So, Ashley, welcome.
Good morning.
And we have at hand, as I said earlier, the opening of the 80th season of the Spokane Symphony Orchestra. And quite a program it is, too, because it features as its centerpiece the first symphony, the Titan Symphony of Gustav Mahler, about which quite a bit more in a few minutes. But let's run down the rest of the program, beginning with music of a composer who we just played earlier in the last hour, Alexander Zemlinsky. And James, if you could, why is he not a composer name on everyone's lips?
That's a good question. I don't know, because I love the music of Zemlinsky. He wrote a piece called Seejungfrau, the Mermaid, which actually was kind of about Alma Mahler, interestingly. But it's an incredible work. And I think he was very big and Mahlerian, late romantic. So why he's not as popular, I don't know. At the start of our story this week, he was Alma Mahler's composition teacher. And in fact, they were lovers as well. But she left him to go and marry Gustav Mahler, who then famously said, "There's only room for one composer in our marriage, and it's going to be me," which he regretted later. And then he recanted and then actually had her songs published. Thank goodness. But yeah, so Zemlinsky, I don't know why he's not more performed. It's music that really speaks to me. I love the kind of late romantic, lush orchestral writing, and he does that so well. The piece we open with is a very kind of light and frothy little concert opener. It comes from an intermezzo in his opera, translated as Once Upon a Time, Es war einmal. And it's a very silly opera about a princess who's very petulant and ends up marrying a vagabond who turns out to be a prince. The usual kind of nonsense you get in,
of course,
opera.
Yes.
And either they end in marriage or death. That's the two ways an opera can end, right? This one ends in marriage. And so it's just a very nice little frothy concert opener. But I wanted Zemlinsky there as this kind of extra person in the love triangle between Alma and Gustav.
Oh, so many love triangles when you get into the history of music. That gets things off to, as you said, a wonderfully frothy start, because there's ultimately serious work to be done in approaching the music of Gustav Mahler. But then following in the first half of the program, we have Ashley Dixon coming on stage to sing music of Alma Mahler. And first of all, Ashley, let me introduce you to Spokane audiences. Is this your first trip here to sing with the symphony?
This is. This is my first time in Spokane.
Well, welcome. Hope you find a nice home here for your duration of your stay. And tell us a little bit about you and how you got started, because you are probably best known for your work in the operatic world. But as we'll find out, you are also a lover of song writ large. But when did the singing bug first bit? And maybe more importantly, when did the opera bug bite?
Right. I started singing. Well, I always loved to sing growing up as a child. There was always music in my house. My parents would buy every CD that came out, whether they knew who the artist was or not. There was always music in my house, so there was always singing. But I didn't know that that was a possibility, that you could do this as a career, and I didn't really know much about opera. And then my choral teacher in high school also taught, Franklin Green, also taught voice. And he came up to me one day, I'll never forget it, after school, and he stopped me and he said, "I think you should really take voice lessons." And my first thought was, "Oh my God, am I that bad?" And he said, "No, I think you actually have potential to do something with your voice." And so he started training me around my junior year of high school and introduced me to opera. I remember the first record we played was the Grace Bunbury Carmen with John Vickers as Don José. And I was, I mean, immediately just hooked by the, you know, hooked by it all. And he told me, you know, you can go to college for this. And I was like, you can? You can just sing all day? And so I went to Louisiana State University for my undergrad and then followed that with a master's at University of Michigan. And there is where I met the amazing pianist Martin Katz, who taught at University of Michigan and really took me under his wing while I was there and showed me all the possibility of song. And I forced myself onto every recital that I possibly could be on and learned all the song repertoire and really prepared me to go out into the world and pretty much do opera and song, you know, in the same capacity going forward. And then I did my training at the San Francisco Opera in the Adler program. I did my young artist training there. And after that, so I was supposed to be here prior pandemic, right after I had finished the Adler program. And then, wonderfully enough, have been able to reschedule this to now to sing these amazing songs.
It's really great that you were a part of that Adler program.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It was very formative for me.
Because there are so many really, really fine singers and singers with name recognition who have been a part of that. Did you get to do small roles with the company when you were
Yes,
there?
Yeah. So my time there, we would cover a lot of the larger roles, which was we would learn the score of the and understudy the main artist that was singing. And then we would also perform the small roles within the opera. So I did things like The Sandman and Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel. I did The Italian Singer and Manon Lescaut, Mercedes and Carmen, while also covering understudying Carmen, which was craziness. I remember one time the Carmen turned to me and she's like, I think you're singing my line in the quintet. I was like, I honestly don't know what line I'm singing in the quintet. Everybody's singing so fast. I don't know which one I've learned.
That is kind of a horse race, that particular piece. Well, let's focus on song literature, since that's what you're going to be doing on these concerts. Then I should say that the 80th season, wow, that's a big number. 80th season of the Spokane Symphony begins this weekend with the first Masterworks concerts, and they are at 7:30 on Saturday night, and they are also on Sunday afternoon at 3. And something new, here at SPR Classical, our schedules have just completely changed, and those who work here are still trying to accommodate ourselves to that and adjust ourselves to it. But that means that there's a change in Concert of the Week. Concert of the Week returns a week from Saturday, and that's at 12 noon. So if you missed the Masterworks program or if you want to hear it again, that's the way to do it, next Saturday at 12 noon. And that's the new home for Concert of the Week. Okay, Ashley and James, Alma Mahler and her songs. Let's pull back the curtain.
Well, Alma Mahler is just this fascinating woman in musical history. She was far more than Gustav Mahler's wife. She really had a pivotal role in the lives of many, many, many people. And, you know, she sits at the nexus of this incredible time in kind of turn-of-the-century Vienna. She was surrounded by Klimt. Sigmund Freud was there, obviously Mahler. And there's this incredible artistic flowering, of which she was a kind of central figure. And for me, what's fascinating really is how incredible her songs are and how in many ways they're, at least one or two of them in the set that we're presenting this weekend, are way out of head of where Gustav Mahler was. And compositionally, she, I always think, a couple of these songs have more in common with early Alban Berg. So kind of much more advanced than her husband and writing kind of a slightly earlier time as well. So that makes her a very fascinating character. But then when you hear these songs, they are set with such incredible refinement and intelligence and response to the every word of this beautiful German poetry that I just think she was a very, very serious composer. And it's a tragedy that we only have her up to her kind of early 20s that we didn't hear what she was writing in her 80s when she was still alive, still going.
Right. She lived from 1879 to 1964, so just in a good long lifespan, and all the things that she saw. And again, that's so true, that period of time around the turn of the 20th century in Vienna and Paris both. You mentioned that if you could get in the Wayback Machine, that's probably would be your first destination.
That would be it, yeah. I think turn of the century Paris and turn of the century Vienna would probably be where some of my favorite art in all time has come from. And just to be in that world, I think, would be incredible. But then there's the dentistry. So,
well, you know, and the antibiotics and little things like that.
Then again, I'm English, so the dentistry angle.
Ashley, tell us a little bit about your connection with Alma Mahler's songs.
Right. So I had known about Alma Mahler, known that she was the wife of Gustav, but wasn't really connected to her songs in any way until, you know, my later discoveries. And, you know, when I first kind of came upon them, I was thinking, oh, this is going to be, you know, very similar to Mahler, or, you know, echo some of his writing. And it is very different. And in a refreshing way, there is still the folk angle that she takes with this poetry, but it's done in a very elegant way. And then, like was said before, in such a short period of time where she's written these songs, you can tell the compositional growth that she had from from one to the next, which is kind of crazy, where the last song, the Harvest Song in the set, there's Berg, there's Straussian moments, there's all of these moments that really Mahler never had. And it's so amazing to think of how far she came in her compositional life in such a short period of time. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the cool things you get to see with this program of seven songs.
Right. Would that more of her material had survived, because she apparently wrote some 50 songs throughout the course of her life, and only about 17 or so of them actually are still with us.
Yeah. You never know. They may be sitting somewhere in someone's attic.
There's a box somewhere that's
waiting
to be opened, and waiting for this other box to get gone from top of it, and there will be. Let's hope that it'd be a really good thing. Before we leave the topic of the songs, what are the texts like? What are you singing about in these songs? Is there somebody that's part of the entire set, or is each unique?
They're thematically different in each song. Like a lot of German poetry, very romantic, some of it is more heady than others. Some of it is more straightforward. There are some storytelling within some of these, like in Meines Vaters Garten, she takes you through a story, which is it's the third song in the Fünflieder, but it's the fifth song in this cycle. But she uses poets that Rilke, all these great poets of the time, and sets it pretty beautifully.
It's a friend of mine. It's described. She said, all of German poetry can be described as the world is beautiful and I am sad.
Yes,
it kind of is like that. But yeah, the poems are absolutely astonishing, and they go from this kind of huge kind of looking outward to some incredibly intimate moments. In fact, my favorite song is the simplest of the set, and it's just two people holding each other. And they just say, let's just be really quiet here. And, nobody knows it. Nobody else knows us like this, is how it ends. And it's lovely. I mean, it's kind of Netflix and chill before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
Ashley Dixon will be the singer in the songs of Alma Mahler. Now, this, James, these were orchestrated. What Alma Mahler wrote was the piano accompaniment to the songs.
That's right, yes. Yeah. So Alma's original version is piano and voice. And this set has been orchestrated by Colin and David Matthews, who are two brothers who are English composers. I've worked with David Matthews, but they're very kind of well respected, and they bring a very kind of colourful reimagining of Alma's piano writing.
Colin Matthews, who maybe most famously gave Pluto voice.
That's right.
The planets.
That's right. And he, the, before Pluto wasn't a planet again.
That's right. Pluto just can't catch a break.
I know.
Well, this question will be for both of you as we open up the mysteries of the Symphony No. 1, the Titan Symphony. And I need to tell a short anecdote that goes back to my teaching days. And this this was in high school. And a student came to me before class one day, just absolutely alight, just this beaming countenance, and so excited to tell me that he had made a discovery last night. Mahler, Gustav Mahler, he could barely contain himself. And did you have a similar, James, I think you were saying you had a similar moment.
Oh, I had exactly the same moment. So my dad, as I got into classical music as a kind of teenager, my dad, God bless him, kind of signed us up for a CD of the month club. And you had to kind of opt out, otherwise they'd send you a CD and a bill. And we forgot to tick no one month and got this Abbado recording of Mahler 5. And I thought, oh, one symphony on one disc, that's probably a bit. And then I listened to it and it just blew me apart. I mean, it was just such incredible music. I never heard anything like it. And then, of course, like every teenager, as a teenager, I think Mahler really speaks to you, because this whole thing of Mahler is heightened emotion, life at the extremes of experience of it. And I think it really speaks to a kind of teenager in us. And so I think when you meet that music at that age, it's a love affair that you just keep with you for the rest of your life.
Symphony No. 1 took a long time to write, took a long time to get to its final form. Interesting process.
Yeah, I mean, it started out as a symphonic poem, that's to say a piece of music that tells a story. And I think he did that because he felt that his music was so way out there that it wouldn't be swallowed as a symphony. And he was probably right about that. I think there was quite a lot of critical pushback. In fact, throughout his whole life, I mean, he really didn't become this hugely important compositional figure until the 1950s, 1960s, this big revival of Mahler. You know, if you look at encyclopedias from early 20th century, they always say Gustav Mahler, well known as a conductor, a composer of little importance, you know. So, so yes, it was a difficult birth for the symphony. And he famously said that a symphony must embrace the world. And it does. It includes folk music. There's klezmer in there. There's Austrian kind of Ländler, which is like the peasant version of the waltz. Mm-hmm. There's I think Schrammelmusik, which is this very cheesy music that they play in wine tasting rooms, even now in Vienna. And it's all in there. And it's this tumult of a young person in the original going out to the world. The first movement is based, in fact, on a song that he wrote previously, which is this beautiful Lieder eines Feiern, the Gazelle, and the Songs of a Wayfarer. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you just played
it.
The world. And then, you know, he meeting the world in all its glory and difficulty. But for me, the single most incredible and moving moment of the whole symphony is probably its most intimate. The third movement is a very weird satirical setting of Frère Jacques in the minor key.
In a minor key.
And it's supposed to represent the animals at the huntsman's funeral. So they're kind of ironically being sad. And then there are these little interludes. One interlude is very kind of klezmer and they're having kind of fun. And then there's this incredible moment where, totally out of nowhere, he puts in the end of the Wayfarer songs, where the man who's been going out into the world, the young man in the Wayfarer, has fallen massively in love and had his heart ripped apart and is just devastated. And he sees a lime tree over the street, and he goes and lies in it. And the leaves of the tree fall on him like snow. And I think, actually, you were saying it's an incredibly heartbreaking moment in that.
Yes. I mean, even if you have no idea what the words are, when you hear that song or when you hear that moment, it will bring you to tears and you're like, I don't know why I'm crying, but this is so heartbreaking. It's pretty incredible.
And the metaphor, of course, is that he's died under mm-hmm. this tree. Mm-hmm. And then you have this incredible moment and there's a second of stasis and then comes back this kind of minor key Frère Jacques. And I think Mahler is telling us in this that we can experience the most incredibly profound things, but the world still goes on there in all its parody and grotesqueness and difficulty, and somehow that's just how things are. Mm-hmm. So that was Mahler's genius for me, is that when he says he wants to embrace the world, that's what he's doing. He's taking the most incredibly intimate human experiences that we can have, and also the total banality of life, and putting them right next to each other and saying, well, this is just how it is.
And there are moments like that just throughout the piece, absolutely. And Mahler embraces the world. That's a very good way to put it. And he uses techniques that have been around for a long time, but they're very highly personalized.
There are. I mean, what I find interesting with always Mahler is he always uses a huge orchestra. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got about 90 people on stage for this performance. And he doesn't just use it to make an awful lot of racket, although he does. He also uses it so he can break out these weird combinations of solo instruments, of chamber music within these huge, big structures. And actually, for me, I think some of the most impressive and beautiful music of Mahler is not the smash-bang ending, so much as these moments of real, quiet, delicate intimacy that put everything else in that. You put the loud music in a context. But yes, I mean, he has all these techniques, like he has the wind players have to lift their instruments, so the bells of their instruments mm-hmm. above the music stand, so it looks like they're cannoning the sound out over into the audience. He even has the horns, eight of which we are using,
eight
by the
horns,
way,
yes.
standing mm-hmm. up at one point, and at the end, they stand up. At the very beginning of the symphony, it's representing, you know, he lived near a garrison town as a child. And it's representing him kind of sitting in the forest and listening to the sounds of the forest. But in the distance, you can hear the garrison trumpets. So he has three trumpets way off stage playing a fanfare very loudly, but so far away that it sounds very quietly in the hall. I mean, really theatrical mm-hmm. elements in all of his symphonies, but just a bottomless imagination for sound.
And so it is, and so you will be immensely rewarded if you are able to be at the opening of the 80th season of the Spokane Symphony Orchestra this weekend at the Fox Theater. This program featuring music of Alma Mahler, Gustav Mahler, and Alexander Zemlinsky. Just a great, great program, I think.
And I would say, if you have not experienced Mahler live in the flesh, it's a very different experience. You can listen to it on a recording, it's amazing. But the live experience, it is really something special. It's not an average concert. Every time Mahler is performed, it is something really genuinely transformational.
All right. So be there. And Saturday evening at 7:30 and Sunday afternoon at 3. James Lowe, thank you for today, for the week, for doing what you do. And leading the orchestra on and ever to higher heights.
So thank you. It's been such a fun week to be here with you. Thank you, Jim.
And Ashley Dixon, delighted to meet you and really looking forward to your performance of the Alma Mahler songs on the weekend.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And so we close this edition of From the Studio. We're going to go out with the music of Alexander Zemlinsky again, although this is a bit different. This is the conclusion of his symphony in B-flat major. Again, our conductor is Ricardo Chailly, and he leads the Radio Symphony Orchestra of Berlin.